Hey Weirdos, I'm scheduled for jury duty this week, and well, we never know what's going to be entailed in that kind of thing, so I'm posting some Dark Archives episodes to use until my civic duty is done.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
One day, while she was washing her hair in the kitchen sink, she said that she had such a gut-churning feeling of doom come over her that she nearly passed out. The room filled with a putrid odor, and she felt someone's breath on the back of her neck. She was too terrified to turn around, afraid of what she might see. So she threw the shampoo bottle behind her in a desperate attempt to hit whatever was in the room with her. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're listening on the radio or on a streaming station, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, too. I upload episodes 7 days a week. And if you're already a member of our Weirdo family, please take a moment and invite a friend, family member, or coworker to listen in. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, it's a special Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness, where I reach back into the archives and bring out some dark and strange stories you might not have heard yet, as they are from several years ago. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into this Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness.
The ability to change the past and get an insight into the future has often resulted in the creation of the most remarkable time-altering machines. A very strange case involving time travel and power to change timelines was reported in 1977. The case caused a sensation worldwide. Had Sid Hurwicz, the creator of the time-altering machine, really found a way to alter historical events? Born in 1918, Sid Hurwicz was a Jewish appliance repairman living in Toronto, Canada, who used to experiment with various kinds of technology. As a child, Sid showed great interest in collecting random junk and assembling the pieces into working machines. Later, as an adult, he became famous as the man who could fix anything that was broken. In 1934, Sid earned the distinction of being the first private appliance repairman in all of Canada. He was such a skilled technician that the local power company succeeded in taking him out of the army so he could develop the infrastructure of the public electrical utility. Sid Hurwicz earned enough money to set up two successful companies of his own. He was still young when he got a heart attack, only 36, and he retired. Hurwicz continued to experiment with various tech devices until one day he finally invented a remarkable device that could freeze, or rather change, the flow of time. This machine also had the ability to send out beams of influence to manipulate objects in distant locations. In 1969, a wave of bank robberies swept through Toronto, and local authorities had trouble catching the thieves. Hurwicz contacted the police and offered his help, saying it was possible to freeze time to find out what transpired. The article in the Vancouver Sun-Times gives this account. "All I recall," said Bolton, one of the police officers in charge, is that it was under the table. The device, whatever it was, and there was a bedspread over the table. He froze my service revolver. You couldn't pull the trigger. You couldn't lift it up off the table, and even on the table, you couldn't pull the trigger. Sid responded by saying, "Now, take a look at your watches." I remember one of them said, "When did this happen?" And I said, "The minute you walked through that door. You walked in there about 25 minutes ago. Now, look at your watches. You're late about 25 minutes." As the security officers filed out of his home, Sid's wife overheard one of them suggest that the Army should be told about the device. That was the first time it entered my mind for war or Army purposes or anything like that. As it so often happens with new, brilliant inventions, the time-altering machine was later used by the military, or so it was reported. According to an article that appeared in 1977 in a British publication called Foreign Report, Sid Hurwitz's time-altering machine ended up in Israel, where it was used by the military. The device sends out electronic rays to alter the natural composition of electronic fields and centers of gravity of weapons, instrument dials, and mechanical devices. Using the Hurwitz principle, there was no reason why the new beams could not reach and disable tanks, ground-to-ground missiles, and complete radar systems. The beams could also be tacked together to form a screen that would make whole zones safe from bombs and missiles, Foreign Report stated. Whether the time machine is still in possession of the Israeli military or not has been widely debated. Does the Israeli military still have the Hurwitz device, and are they still using it on special occasions or in dire situations of military crisis? Skeptics say that if they really had a device that could provide a kind of shield from bombs and missiles, freeze weapons, and even slow or halt time, the Israeli military would be invincible and would not have suffered as many casualties as it has in its decades-long struggles with the antagonists in the Mideast. Others counter, however, by saying that the Hurwitz device may be a two-edged sword. If it can freeze the weapons of the enemy, it would also freeze the weapons of those employing the device. Thus, the device can perhaps only be used in a limited way, enough to knock out radar detection and other enemy electronics, for example, but not to induce the full-blown time-freeze effect for the benefit of the user, Bullivant Richard writes in his book, The Time Travel Stories. Although many people have written and speculated about the time-altering device of Sid Hurwitz over the years, there has never been a follow-up story since it appeared in the Vancouver paper in 1977. What happened to Sid Hurwitz is also unclear. By now he has passed on, but it is interesting to note that researchers have not been able to find his obituary or any information about him. It is as if he vanished into thin air. When he talked to the police, he said, "It's not really a new invention. It's designed on principles that are already well known. I just thought of it one day. When I heard about the bank robberies, I knew this could work." The time-altering machine created by Sid Hurwitz could be one of the world's greatest inventions, but its whereabouts are shrouded in mystery, perhaps deliberately.
There's more of this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness still to come. Hey Weirdos, Weird Darkness has been nominated for a podcast award in 4 categories this year: Storyteller Drama, Society and Culture, True Crime, and the coveted People's Choice category. You can vote for Weird Darkness in all 4 categories at the same time by visiting podcastawards.com. Once you sign up to vote, you'll find all 4 categories in the left-hand column. People's Choice at the very top, and then bottom left-hand column for the remaining 3 when you scroll down. While it's still on your mind right now, please, go vote! Only you, my weirdo family, can help Weird Darkness become an award-winning podcast this year. Go to podcastawards.com and vote for Weird Darkness in the Storyteller Drama category, the Society and Culture category, the True Crime category, and the People's Choice category. And thank you, Weirdo Family, for nominating and voting for Weird Darkness. Every month, one email newsletter subscriber is chosen at random to win a Weird Darkness prize pack. You could be my next winner. Sign up for the newsletter for free at WeirdDarkness.com. When I was a small child, barely able to walk, I was given a musical box by an aged friend of my aunt. It was made from a dark brown wood and painted on the top. It had a colorful picture of a carousel with white horses and a red striped top. I remember to this day the strange metallic sound of the tune that it played, tinkling above the whirl of the clockwork motor, which was wound by a lever fixed within a slot in the side. Although I remember the tune clearly and can hum it, I've never been able to identify the title of the music. It has just 14 notes and plays for less than half a minute before repeating itself over and over again until the spring is unwound. The tune has haunted me for all of my life, but now it's worming its way into my very soul and slowly destroying me. The box had disappeared from my life well before I started school. Where it went and why remains a mystery. Perhaps it was lost or broken or maybe given away to another small child, but I hope not. I do not know and I do not care. It is still in my life, though, and I will never be free of it. The curious tune is both simple and persistent. It all starts on a high note and drops in key before rising again. The music seems familiar but is not recognizable as any popular or common tune. I've not heard any other music box with the same song, for a song, for me, is what it is. I can put words to it, but the words are mine, and have an evil aspect to them, as though the box is revealing a secret from the past in notes of music straight into my head. I now have knowledge of how these devices work, but still cannot comprehend why this tune affects me so. The mechanics of the box are simple, but the structure of them is complicated. The musical notes are made by the vibrations of the teeth of a brass comb. Each tooth is plucked by a tiny pin set into a revolving cylinder. There are many pins on the cylinder, and these are arranged to play the notes in the order of the tune. The clockwork motor drives the cylinder, the speed controlled by a fan attached to a continuous worm drive, which ensures the rhythm of the music is maintained. The sound is amplified through the wooden box. It is a simple but sophisticated device, a device of wood and metal, nothing more. But why am I affected so? For 75 years, it ruled my mind. My very being is swamped in the sounds and music of the box. For some years now, the sound of the box has been heard from time to time, softly tinkling its unknown melody in the darkness of the night. I wake in the close pitch black, the sound enveloping me but seeming to come from far away. From time to time, I rise from my warm bed and roam the house in the swamp of night, trying desperately to locate its source. And in the bright daylight, I search again, in places so familiar that they need no search. It's not there and never has been. But what does this mean? Am I haunted? Can I never be free of the music of my life? On holiday many years ago, I passed through a mountain village in Switzerland, traveling back to England from Italy by coach. As we dropped down the steep, twisting road into the village, a vision through the tall pine trees caught my attention for a moment or two. I saw the striped roof of a carousel below, the white horses impaled by twisted golden shafts, set off by a dark wooden floor and revolving slowly. We passed by closely as the road leveled out, and my attention was taken by a small child
standing alone and staring intently at me as we rushed by. Some few minutes later, the coach pulled into a hotel car park, a stop for refreshments and lunch. I felt that I had to see the carousel, and foregoing food and drink, I made my way back along the road in the direction in which we had come. I found the pine trees and the gap between them. The carousel had gone, or maybe had not been there at all, but I still swear I had seen it to this day. Retracing my steps, I looked about me, and on reaching the level area, noticed a small memorial stone set close against an old flint wall. It was the memorial to a child of 4 years old. He had died after falling from a carousel horse, crushed to death by the iron wheels of the revolving deck. He had died on the very day that I was born, 75 years before, and we also share the same name. I asked the others on the coach about the carousel, but nobody had noticed it as the bus passed by. I'm now entering my 100th year, and still, the mystic music plays. It worries me, and I rarely sleep through the nights. Will I ever find peace in my life? Why was the box given to me? And what does this all mean? Pankersick Castle is a fortified Tudor manor house hidden away in Pross Sands, Cornwall. The oldest part still standing dates from 1500, but there has been a building on this site for at least 900 years. It is reportedly the most haunted castle in Britain. Many people claim to have encountered some of the 20-odd ghosts said to be here. Many have seen or photographed strange orbs of light. Electrical malfunctions are commonplace. There are massive temperature drops. The ghosts said to be haunting Pankersick Castle include a 14th-century monk, a 13-year-old girl who danced to her death off the battlements, a 4-year-old boy who tugs at ladies' dresses, the reenactment of a medieval murder, a woman seen walking through a wall and pacing the room, a woman stabbed to death in the castle, and a man stabbed and strangled in 1546 in front of a fireplace. The Ghost Club has carried out many late-night vigils at the castle, and there's been a televised display of automatic writing, which resulted in a scribbled picture of a female face. Pankersick Castle is widely accepted as the most haunted location in the UK, and it has been the subject of many television programs, as well as getting a mention in numerous books, media, and publications. It is a striking building and has many good reasons to make a visit. It primarily is a private residence, but the owners make the house and grounds available as often as they can and are investing in research and digs to find out more about the house and grounds. The ghost tours continue to be very popular. My Aunt Teresa was always a great source of ghost stories for me. She'd lived in a haunted apartment when she was first married. Later, towards the end of her life, she'd been the owner of a cuckoo clock that spoke to her every night at 3 o'clock on the dot. I'll start with the story of her apartment. When my aunt was newly married, she and my uncle moved into a small apartment in the town of Hinton, West Virginia. It was the 1960s, and life was just beginning for them. The apartment was nothing fancy, but it was their first home together, and they loved it. At first. Aunt Teresa had always been connected to the spirit world. She and my grandmother both spoke in tongues when they were overcome by the Holy Spirit. It was actually quite frightening to see when I was a child, but they assured me that it was a good thing. Even though my aunt was fundamentalist Christian, she also believed in ghosts and the supernatural. Strange events seemed to follow her everywhere she went. It didn't frighten her until she moved into the apartment in Hinton. My aunt's first inkling that something wasn't quite right in her new apartment was the uneasy feeling she had that she was being watched. She told me many times that no matter where she went in the apartment or what she was doing, someone was watching her. Unseen eyes bore into her 24 hours a day. She got to the point of staying away from home as much as possible when my uncle was at work so she could have some peace. The longer they lived there, the worse things got. They began fighting constantly. They had always gotten along well and enjoyed being together, but that all changed once they were in the apartment. My uncle worked long hours and made a point of staying gone even on his days off. My aunt would go to my grandmother's house rather than be at home alone. One day, while she was washing her hair in the kitchen sink, she said that she had such a gut-churning feeling of doom come over her that she nearly passed out. The room filled with a putrid odor, and she felt someone's breath on the back of her neck. She was too terrified to turn around, afraid of what she might see. So she threw the shampoo bottle behind her in a desperate attempt to hit whatever was in the room with her. The putrid smell lifted, and the cloistering feeling in the room faded. She turned around, only to find an empty apartment and shampoo all over the floor. When my uncle returned home that evening, she told him what had happened. He laughed at her. He hated the apartment and knew that something wasn't right there, but he didn't believe her. She wanted to move out right then, but she had nowhere to go. Incidents like the one in the kitchen began to happen regularly. Nothing happened when my uncle was around. Everything seemed to center around my aunt. She would be performing some mundane task like folding laundry when all at once the room would be enveloped in the smell of rotting garbage. She would choke on the foul odor and usually flee to my grandma's house. She didn't know the source of the smell, but she did know that it was not good and it was not of this world. The overwhelming feeling of being constantly watched took a toll both mentally and physically on my aunt. She never felt safe in the home. Even while taking a bath to relax, she would be reminded that she was not alone. She would close the bathroom door and submerge herself in the warm, soapy water, only to have the door fly open, even though she was supposedly the only one home. My mother was a witness to the evil presence that had settled in my aunt's apartment. She had spent some time there while my father was in the military. My mom said that even though she didn't smell the horrible decaying stench that haunted my aunt, she did have the overwhelming feeling that someone was watching them at all times. My mother was so uncomfortable there that she cut her stay short and opted to spend the remaining time with my grandmother. My aunt begged her to stay, but she couldn't bring herself to spend any more time in that apartment. My mom wasn't the only visitor to my aunt's apartment who felt the presence of something sinister. My cousin Larry would come to stay with them occasionally when he was in town. When he stayed there, he slept on the living room couch. He said that he'd be awakened in the middle of the night by the sounds of whispering. He would see shadowy figures sitting on the chairs which sat adjacent to the couch. The figures would be pointing at him and whispering. After one particularly harrowing encounter with the night whisperers, he cut his visit short and checked into a motel for the remainder of his stay. It took one undeniable act to finally convince my uncle that it was time to move. my aunt and uncle were sleeping soundly one night when they were awakened by loud pounding on the door. My uncle, furious at having been jolted out of a sound sleep, stormed to the door and flung it open. There was no one there. He slammed the door and bolted the lock before returning to bed. He had no more than lay under the covers when the banging on the door started again. He jumped up and ran to catch the prankster who was keeping him from his much-needed sleep. He opened the door only to find the hallway vacant. There was no one stirring in any of the apartments. The building was quiet. Puzzled and still fuming, he decided to sit up in the living room. If they knocked again, he would catch them. He sat facing the door. A few minutes passed, and the pounding started again. He not only heard it this time, he saw it. The whole door moved as he stood up to confront whoever was on the other side. The door crashed open with such force that it knocked a hole in the wall. My uncle was in shock at this point. There was not a soul there. Just my uncle and my terrified aunt, who had heard the crash and stood trembling in the hallway. Whatever had been banging on the door and eventually broke it open was nowhere to be seen. My aunt and uncle moved out the next day. My uncle never once spoke to me of that incident or any others involving the apartment. He put it behind him and pretended it never happened. The memories of it never left my aunt. She spoke of it until the time of her death.
Keep listening. There's more of this special Darkhives episode of Weird Darkness on the way. Have you checked out the brand new Monster Channel? It has horror hosts, B-horror movies, retro television commercials, and a whole lot more. You can watch it anytime, 24/7, 365, on the Monster Channel page at WeirdDarkness.com. It's also where we hold our Weirdo Watch Parties each month. Get your monster movie fix on the Monster Channel at WeirdDarkness.com. If you like Weird Darkness, you'll want to also listen to some of the free audiobooks I've narrated, with titles by Stephen King, H.P. Lovecraft, Charles Dickens, and more. Check out all the audiobooks I've narrated on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com.
Although many of old Louisville's most impressive mansions of the Gilded Age can be found along the stretch of South 3rd Street, known as Millionaire's Row, splendid homes can be found throughout the entire neighborhood. Given that at one time it marked the southmost extension of the original city, Ormsby Avenue has some of the earliest and largest residences in the area. The comfortable upper-middle-class enclaves of 1st and 2nd Streets both have impressive dwellings known for their innovative architectural styles, and St. James and Belgravia Court mansions and townhomes have come to epitomize the charm and elegance of old Louisville's Victorian past. But if one street in old Louisville can rival South 3rd Street for the size and grandeur of its Gilded Age masterpieces, it would be 4th Street. Once an exclusive address for the city's merchants, downtown 4th Street transformed itself from a pastoral residential district to a bustling center of commerce and entertainment by the end of the 19th century. Although no visible reminders of the once vibrant housing scene that characterized the street north of Broadway remain, the southern stretch that passes through Old Louisville boasts quite a number of spacious and elegant mansions from the city's golden age. One of these sits at the corner of 4th and Park in the heart of Old Louisville, known by many as the Russell Houston Mansion. 1332 South 4th Street counts as one of the most inviting and elegant Victorian queens in the neighborhood. And like so many homes in Old Louisville, it has its share of stories and legends. Construction on the 7,400-square-foot residence started in the mid-1880s, a heady time for Louisville because of the excitement and national publicity generated by the famous Southern Exposition. Russell Houston, a judge and president of the L&N Railroad, was the first owner and prominent Kentucky architect Maury Mason designed the eye-catching red brick masterpiece with elements of the popular Richardsonian Romanesque style of the exterior. Historians William Morgan and Samuel H. Thomas have described its appearance as a picturesque massing of brick into a powerful composition of tremendous originality, making special note of the highly decorative red stone trim, sills, coining, belt courses, lintels, and columns that unify the lovely facade. A jaunty turret juts from the south-facing corner, and a lone dormer perches on the steep-pitched roof over a graceful third-floor balcony. In the spacious foyer, arriving guests notice inviting coffered ceilings and an impressive stairway that gently wraps its way around to the second floor. The one-of-a-kind fireplace in the dining room features an embedded window in a double-flue chimney with an enviable view of the green heart of Old Louisville, the Olmsted-designed Central Park that replaced Old DuPont Square in 1905. And in addition to the many charming details and antique furnishings that fill the interior spaces, rumor has it that a resident haunt adds her own special character to the home of Russell Houston. Known as Annie Whipple, she is a tall and school-marmly specter that has been seen ascending and descending the lovely curving staircase in the residence. And those who have seen the ghost believe her sad disposition is due to something that happened over 100 years ago when Annie Whipple worked in the lovely brick mansion across from Central Park. According to local lore, Annie Whipple was a mysterious widow who arrived from New England in the late 1800s after her husband, a whaling captain, had been lost at sea. She had a teaching background and eventually became a live-in nanny at the Houston home, where she enjoyed a position of authority and respect. That is, until one day when she started to dabble in the practice of the black arts. At least that's what May Farrell told me one day over coffee in the front parlor. It was during my last month there at the Widmer house, and I'd been packing boxes on the third floor when the doorbell rang. When I went down to answer it, I found a spry woman in her 80s, smiling and telling me she had just bought one of my books. As if to prove her story, she pulled out a copy and asked if I wouldn't mind signing it for her. Glad for a break from my moving chores, I asked her to come inside, and I had her sit while I autographed and dedicated the book for her. She was a very chatty lady, and before I knew it, I was offering her coffee and cake and listening to her tale about Annie Whipple. It was a story that had intrigued me before, but no matter how much I researched, I was never able to pull up any real corroboration with historical events or actual places in Old Louisville, so I just assumed it was a legend and decided to treat it as such. At least with May Farrell, I would have another version of the story to compare my notes with. The story she told me not only confirmed a great deal of the particulars I had already heard, it also added some new and interesting details. Annie Whipple, it seems, had only been with the family for a couple of years when yellow fever struck the household. She helped nurse them back to health. However, one of the children, a girl she had grown quite attached to, wasn't getting any better, and the doctor finally said he could do nothing more for her and told the family to prepare for her imminent death. Annie Whipple nonetheless refused to give up and stayed at the girl's bedside day and night. Other than use cold compresses and weak tea to make the girl feel comfortable in her fits of delirium, there was little Annie Whipple could do. So she leafed through the local newspapers, catching up on the day's events as she kept watch at the girl's side. Often the reports consisted of stories about local mediums and psychics and updates from the spiritualist movement. But Annie Whipple, by all accounts, didn't subscribe to such notions. One day, however, one story caught her eye, and Annie Whipple read it with interest about a local doctor known to cure not only bewitched people, but also patients with all sorts of ailments. When she read about his miraculous powers, Annie Whipple immediately had the idea to contact him and see if he couldn't help cure the sick girl under her care. So she rushed down the stairs, hitched up the horse and buggy and drove over to see Dr. Anderson the next day, said May Farrell. Although the previous versions of the legend I had heard always included references to a doctor with strange powers, May Farrell was the first person to put a name with the man, Dr. Anderson. When poor Annie Whipple got there, she noticed that the front doors of his house and adjacent practice were all decked out in black bunting. Someone had died. As fate would have it, Dr. Anderson himself had died just the day before, and Annie Whipple was forced to return home without the help she so desperately sought. There, she resumed her post at the ailing girl's bedside, in a room next to her own at the top of the stairs on the second floor. As before, the nanny occupied herself with reading the newspaper between attempts to make the girl comfortable. But the next day, when Annie Whipple was reading the Louisville Times or one of the other dailies, she started to pay more attention to the spiritualist news, said May Farrell. She read how many individuals believed they could actually commune with the dead, and how respected scientists were reporting success in their attempts to correspond with the long departed. That's how she came up with her idea. The idea was to attempt to contact the spirit of the recently departed Dr. Anderson in the hopes that he could still offer assistance, but from the other side of the grave. So, under advisement from the old African woman who knew of such things and witchery, Annie Whipple learned the secrets of seance and was given over to finding a cure for the dear girl's misery. According to local sources, the old woman in question was a former slave by the name of Josephine. Some reports say she was from Kentucky, others say she was from Louisiana, which might better explain her knowledge of voodoo, which was usually referred to as hoodoo in this part of the country. On a night when the moon was full, and when frost tipped the breeze with cold, Annie ran down the stairs and out the side door to meet the old woman at the witch's tree, just a block away from where she was living, said May Farrell. When May asked if I had ever heard of the witch's tree before, I told her I had indeed heard about the gnarled old tree that supposedly was a favorite meeting spot for local witches, but I didn't tell her that I was working on a story about this tree for a new book, because I didn't want to distract her from the task at hand. May had gone off on several tangents immediately after starting the story, and we'd already downed many cups of coffee, and I encouraged her to finish. Annie Whipple explained to Josephine that she needed to contact the spirit of Dr. Anderson. Then she gave the old woman some money and listened to her instructions. Afterwards, Annie went home, rushed up the stairs to her room, and did as she had been told. If the story is to be believed, Annie Whipple then engaged in an act referred to as automatic writing, also known as psychography. It is an alleged psychic ability that enables an individual to produce written words that arise from the subconscious or a supernatural source. Many parapsychologists believe this can occur when spirits possess an individual and use the individual's own hands to write out the messages they want to deliver. In this case, Annie Whipple lit a solitary white candle, gathered paper and writing utensils, and sat at the table in her paneled room. She sprinkled over its surface a strange kind of powder given by the old African woman, and then intoned a prayer that had been written out for her, a summons to conjure up the spirit of Dr. Anderson. An eerie hush fell over the room, and although Annie Whipple could see nothing, it seemed a presence hovered at her side. Right before her head slumped and a deep trance took over, she requested Dr. Anderson's advice on how to help the sick girl. Barely aware, Annie Whipple lifted her hand and dipped the pen in ink before scrawling something across the paper on the desk. When she came to and beheld the message, it seemed that a medical prescription had magically appeared before her. Early the next morning, hopeful that a cure was at hand, Annie Whipple ran to a nearby apothecary and had the prescription filled. Once home, she ran swiftly up the stairs to the sick girl and administered the potion. As the nanny waited at the bedside, and as the minutes turned to hours, it became apparent that the medicine had not served its purpose. To the contrary, The girl's condition only worsened, and she fell into a deep, coma-like sleep. The doctor was summoned and explained that the girl would surely expire before the coming dawn. This must have come as a terrible shock to the woman who tried harder than anyone to save the poor girl. Annie Whipple ran to the table in her room, lit the candle, and sprinkled the magic powder over another piece of writing paper before once again summoning assistance from the other side. As before, a hush came upon the room, and although entranced, the nanny remained aware of the surroundings, her limp hand seizing the pen as if to scrawl out a message. But instead of writing, her arm started flailing, and then her hand clutched the pen tightly and began to stab and slash at the wooden top of the desk. Over and over again, some force caused her pen to mar and gouge the writing surface, and then it turned its fury on the paper and started tearing and ripping at the sheet. Soon the paper was torn to shreds, but there remained one piece large enough upon which to scribble a quick message. When she awakened fully, Annie Whipple was no doubt horrified to read the chilling words, "You fool, I am not Dr. Anderson." Annie Whipple reportedly fell to the floor in a heap, insensitive to all external consciousness, and they laid her limp body on the bed, where she lay in fitful slumber till daybreak. When she finally came to, it was only for a moment, as fever racked her body with pain and restlessness, but it was enough time for the nanny to make a confession of the strange things that had transpired the night before. As it turns out, it was kind of a deathbed confession because Annie Whipple died by the time the sun came up. Before she closed her eyes forever, though, she was able to see one last happy sight. There, by her bedside, stood the girl Annie had been caring for. Flushed and glowing, the girl had finally recovered from her illness, perhaps because of the delayed effect of the cure her nanny had procured for her. Was Annie Whipple's life forfeited in exchange for saving the young girl? Was it a cruel spirit from beyond who found a portal to this world and decided to wreak havoc on the person who opened that portal? Nobody can ever know, but since that day, legend holds that Annie Whipple's specter is fated to tread the lovely curved stairway in the mansion where the Houstons once lived, and where she tutored and cared for their children, no doubt reminiscing the day she dabbled in the black arts and surrendered the life she enjoyed on Earth. I think it was just a mean spirit who took it upon himself to teach Annie Whipple a lesson, said May Farrell, as I thanked her for sharing the story and showed her to the door, that Annie Whipple should have left well enough alone. Although initial research on the legend of Annie Whipple turned up little hard substantiation for this haunting, I did make some interesting discoveries concerning the history of spiritualism and what some might consider the black arts in this area. Although the concept of communing with the deceased undoubtedly extends back to the beginnings of mankind and receives no small amount of comment in the Bible, most agree that modern-day spiritualism traces its roots to 1848, when the Fox sisters reportedly made contact with a ghost in their home in upstate New York. Word of the phenomenon soon spread, and within a decade or two, it had taken hold on the imaginations of those in this country and abroad. Among the early cases of spiritualist activity in the Louisville area is a tongue-in-cheek story in the Courier-Journal of 1869 about the very latest in spiritual sensation. It reported, "The latest wonder in Jeffersonville spiritualism is the furnishing of money for shows and buggy riding by spirits to mortals." The specter of Mr. Bud Morgan, deceased several years prior, it explained, had made its headquarters at the residence of Mr. Keegwin, and, it is alleged, that he is daily and almost hourly engaged in conversation with the different members of the family, who converse with him as freely and familiarly as if he were in the flesh. Not only was the deceased generous in his otherworldly correspondence, the piece also reported that members of the Keegwin family enjoyed the good fortune of communing with a spirit who often provided them with money to buy circus tickets and carriage rides. The skepticism many displayed toward spiritualism often included scathing rebukes by the established clergy and warnings against the evils of divining and sorcery. The New York Times of March 31, 1872, picked up on a sensational report about the Lady of Louisville, against whom a Presbyterian church in Louisville, Kentucky, has instituted proceedings for being understood to be a believer in spiritualism. After making the assertion that forbidden intercourse with the dead stemmed from Jewish law, and as such, the Christians of Louisville were not bound by the multitudinous provisions of the Mosaic Code, the writer offered a somewhat liberal piece of advice for the Times. Let the Jewish law, which is supposed to forbid intercourse with the dead, though it is by no means certain that such is its true meaning, we treat it in the same spirit in which we treat the Jewish prohibition of pork. We hold it wrong to eat measly pork, but right to eat wholesome and tender corn-fed pork. In like manner, let association with wicked and morally measly spirits be deprecated, but let us concede the right of any good man to converse with good spirits if he can. In conclusion, the commentator argued that most good spirits, as a rule, preoccupied themselves with rather mundane communications anyway, so any influence they could exert on the lady would most likely be to provoke in her that meditative calmness immediately preceding healthy and innocent sleep. I also came across an interesting article in the New York Times of July 30, 1871 that circulated a story first reported in the New Albany Ledger, which told the strange tale of a supposedly possessed woman in Indiana just across the river from Louisville. What really caught my attention when I quickly scanned the report about the bewitched woman was the mention of a witch doctor by the name of Dr. Anderson, who lived in the city. It seems, therefore, that a Dr. Anderson did indeed exist, lending some degree of credence to the story about Annie Whipple and her ill-fated attempts at communication with the dead. Nonetheless, some might argue that Annie Whipple was successful in that she accomplished her main objective, that of saving the sick girl. I've also come across written accounts of an old hoodoo woman named Josephine and her associations with the old Louisville neighborhood. Like so many of the legends and unsubstantiated stories in old Louisville, reports of these ghostly encounters suggest at least a tenuous connection with the past, a correlation borne out in neighborhood folklore and modern oral traditions. If anyone needs convincing that the specter of Annie Whipple haunts the grand stairway at the Russell Houston home, don't fret. The red brick mansion at the corner of Park and South Fourth was converted to a comfortable bed and breakfast a number of years ago, and owners Herb and Gail Warren welcome overnight guests to come and check it out for themselves. Known as the Inn at the Park, the old Houston place now counts as one of the most popular B&Bs in the neighborhood. Although there haven't been any very recent sightings of a willowy wraith in a high-waisted skirt and lacy white blouse on the graceful curving stairway in the foyer, believers claim it's just a matter of time before she reappears for another round of lessons.
Thanks for listening to this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. And if you've not done so already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. I upload episodes 7 days a week. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me anytime with your questions or comments at darren@weirddarkness.com. That's D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and you can join the Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at weirddarkness.com. While on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story to email it to me. Or tell your story by phone by calling the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. This episode of Weird Darkness is sponsored by Honey, and I have to tell you that having Honey as a sponsor has been more beneficial to me than I could possibly have imagined because, well, I use their browser extension numerous times every week. I have saved money on all sorts of stuff that I used to pay full price for, stuff that I would need to buy anyway. If you don't already have Honey, you're missing out on free savings. It's literally free to use, it's free to download and install, and it only takes a few seconds to install it, and you'll want to install it on every browser extension that you use, so you're never without it when you're online shopping. Honey works for over 30,000 stores online, too. It ranges from tech, gaming, popular fashion brands, even food delivery, which I've not tried but I'm looking forward to. And by getting the Honey browser extension, you're not only doing yourself and your wallet a favor, but you're also doing me a favor as well, because downloading the extension at joinhoney.com/weirddarkness, you're supporting the show. Again, get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/weirddarkness. That's joinhoney.com/weirddarkness. And when you start using it, let me know what you're saving money on. joinhoney.com/weirddarkness.